Jack, you said that this time you might begin by reviewing the basics of doing ethics, especially Christian ethics, and I'm hoping you're going to do that.
Christian ethic depends upon certain presuppositions, we said in our last time together. And those presuppositions are moral presuppositions that in a Christian context we inherit from both Judaism and Christianity. Christ probably said very little about morality that was not already said by some rabbi before him. Mm-hmm. With one exception, at least Rabbi Hillel Silver says there's one exception. That is that no place in the Bible, that is the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, is it said that one should love one's enemies. And Hillel goes on to say that Christ is setting up a standard that nobody can possibly live up to by this extreme statement. But he forgets the Old Testament does talk about helping the enemy. And there is a sense in which the kind of love to which Jesus is referring in the commandment is not just fondness or sentiment. I presume it would be quite impossible for God to expect us to love somebody sentimentally who is our enemy, but to deal kindly with the enemy in spite of the fact that he is our enemy is what Christ is commanding, the difference being the difference between fondness and kindness. You cannot be commanded to be fond, you can be commanded to be kind. And agape suggests something that has volition, has the will. One can choose to love at that level and not at the other. So Hillel Silver is quite incorrect, even with his own understanding of the Old Testament.
You mentioned agape right in there.
Yes.
Could you explain that for a moment?
Yes, agape. You know, as you know, there are four words that can be translated love in the New Testament. And agape is one of them. It's the one that always appears in connection with command. Even the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, agape is the word. If you love God with all your heart, it's the agape is the term for this. And agape is a principle and not an emotion. It depends upon choice, choosing to treat the enemy with respect and kindness, even when, in fact, you may not be fond of him. Because I presume if you could be fond of the enemy, he could be your enemy. But the point being that the Judeo-Christian ethic has certain presuppositions, and one of the major of these presuppositions we didn't discuss last night that stands behind those that we did discuss is the fact that God is conceived of as the creator of everything. Some authorities call this a radical monotheism. God is the author, the sustainer, creator of everything, and his oneness, which is also a basic biblical principle, the oneness of God is projected in his creation, which means there's an orderliness about creation. And violation of the moral law is a violation of that orderliness. Whether at a level that can be clearly branded as moral, or even at other levels, to violate the laws of God are in effect to become immoral. We define morality in terms of harmony with those principles. Now, last night we said that one of the major effects of such a notion is the respect that one has for personhood, for selves. The human being is defined by his having the image of God, which entails the potentiality for being a self, self-defined as conscious, self-conscious, aware, interacting with other selves, capacity for volition, for choice, for responsibility, all those things that you talk about when you say, this is me, or this is I, this is myself. I have that capacity to function, and this is part of the image of God in us. So now, I'd like to take off on that a little bit this evening, because ethics not only has to do with such obvious matters as deciding when the self is present or when the self is lost, it also has to do with providing those protective mechanisms and rules and structures that enable us to look after that self and protect it from being diminished or harmed in any way. So that one of the central concerns of ethics then has to do with protecting that self. Anything that diminishes the self is against God's will, it's against God's intention, and against the creation. God intended men to be selves. To lessen the self is to diminish that creation. And there are various ways in which you can do this, including, for example, some fairly obvious things, chemical reduction of personhood, various kinds of chemical abuse reflect an individual diminishing his self. I did some study some years ago on the effects of certain mind-altering drugs. In fact, I did a doctoral dissertation on the ethical implications of the use of some of these drugs. And one of the things that became obvious after a bit of study was that one of the effects of psychedelic substances, that is, mind-altering substances, is the creation of perceptual distortion, which seems fairly obvious. These people see strange things in these drugs. And in that perceptual distortion, behave sometimes as individuals who have lost their ability to function mentally. Schizophrenia, for example, is primarily a disorder of perception. And if you saw things as a schizophrenic sees them, you might very well behave as a schizophrenic does. It's the perceptual distortion, however, that often lies at the root of their symptomatology. Well, some of these drugs do the same thing, perceptual distortion. But second to this is a disinhibition effect. Now, the capacity to be inhibited may very well be also referring to one's capacity for self-control. That is, one can inhibit one's impulses. Mm-hmm. One has some sort of control over those impulses. And we talk about this as self-determination. But one of the effects of most of these chemicals, even some of those that are not so potent as others, marijuana, for example, is a kind of a soft sister of drugs like LSD, and you'd have to take a fairly sizable amount of marijuana to get effects that are similar to LSD. But these chemicals all have in common this disinhibiting factor, which can be described as suggestion, hypersuggestion. They produce hypersuggestibility. This is one of the reasons why behavioral change is so common in people who use these drugs. That is, a child who is involved in a school experience who is goal-oriented, wants to be a doctor or a preacher, an engineer or something, and he's working hard at it and learning the lessons that he has to learn to prepare for it. If suddenly, in the midst of his training, he comes home and doesn't care anymore, you better look for drugs as the cause for a personality change, and often result of hypersuggestibility. LSD is one of the most suggestible chemicals that we know about. A very minute amount of this sometimes can produce, in a single dose, a value system change, in which the things this person once liked, he now dislikes, and so on, and the behavioral changes that go along with this. One of the researchers that I studied, who lives in Menlo Park, California, said that in his study, 1 out of 10 people who take a single dose of LSD may undergo an irreversible value system change, which we think has to do with the chemical effects upon the midbrain, the reticulum substance, which makes them hypersuggestible, and taken in an environment where a new pattern of life is being suggested by those in his environment. This has a profound effect in changing the individual. But this, you see, this is against self-determination. This means chemically one becomes less able to be self-determinate. And consequently, the image of God is diminished in him by the use of, or the misuse of chemicals such as these.
That's a question right at that point. You indicated last night how important the presuppositions were, and yet that the Christian ethicist would have much in common with the secular ethicist. Now, much of what you've been saying now would have been agreed to
That's
by
correct.
The secular ethicist.
That's correct.
But it adds something to see God as created and
yes.
man created in
yeah.
his image. So when you talk along these lines with audiences holding these various viewpoints, you find that they agree with you.
Accord, agreement. But it also demonstrates another factor in ethics, that often whether or not one successfully follows through the rules that have to do with keeping human life human has to do with motivation.
Mm-hmm.
What Christianity can often bring is a motivational factor that is not present in a person who is secularized. In other words, to avoid these substances mm-hmm. because it is a sin against God to diminish yourself.
That adds something.
That adds a dimension. It's the yeah. same kind of dimension that I suggested last night when we talked about the older use of the term sin to describe mm-hmm. wrong behavior mm-hmm. is over against yeah. sociopathology, maladaptive coping behavior, and so on. Mm-hmm. The word sin has a ring to it because it relates to God and therefore has a higher kind of authority behind it that has motivational significance.
But you, as a believer in God as creator, can talk to a secular audience.
Yes. You do that because we share a value system largely, mm-hmm. even though we may not have the motivational factors mm-hmm. that can make it more effective in one person than another.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm saying that there are certain kinds of things, such as chemical abuse, that can produce hypersuggestibility and a diminution of personhood. But there are behavioral forces that also can produce this. For example, hypersuggestibility is conceived to be one of the major factors in hypnotic trance. in a dissociative state, which is a kind of a separation between that capacity of the ego to maintain self-determinate control and those other recessive qualities that are part of the personality, putting a split between that so the individual now behaves apart from the kind of control mechanism that ordinarily is maintained in self-determination, that it's possible in a trance state, which is the dissociative state, to become vulnerable to the suggestions of others. And that's the basis for the use of hypnosis in modifying behavior. A person who achieves this trance state becomes hyper-suggestible, and in that hyper-suggestible state will carry out actions that are immediately effective and it results from the suggestion, but also have the possibility of long-range...
At least
significantly in that direction. Mm-hmm. Long-range responses to hypnosis we speak of as post-hypnotic suggestion. Mm-hmm. It's possible, for example, if I place you in a trance, to tell you that when you come out of this, you won't remember that I've said this to you, but next year or next week, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to pick up the telephone and call me. Now, you won't remember that I've said this. Mm-hmm. You come out of the trance and next week. In fact, Leslie Weatherhead describes a case that he had in which this girl was a good hypnotic subject, and he placed her in trance one day and said, 1 year from today at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to call me on the telephone. And he said, you won't remember that I've said this. Brought her out of the trance, and she didn't recall he'd said it. And 1 year to the day, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he sat down at his desk and the telephone rang and she was on the other end of the line. And he said, why did you call me? She said, I don't know, I just felt like calling you. There's a case on record of post-hypnotic suggestion lasting for 20 years.
What if you only made noble suggestions to the person?
You may get some behavioral changes. And this is one of the treatments for alcoholism. It's one of the treatments for tobacco. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it doesn't work in everybody. Mm-hmm. And also, there's the potential for the cure being worse than the disease.
Too high a price.
If I relieve you from a habit of smoking and make you less self-determinant in the process, you may be paying too high a price for the treatment. Mm-hmm. Then there are other things which... one modality that is sometimes called chronic hypnosis. Now, a number of studies have been done on the attempts to brainwash people in the communist China and Korea. The Korean engagement. Now, this has been very carefully worked out by mind manipulators so that the techniques were very stylized, very formalized, and very effective. It was based upon Pavlov's experiments with dogs back in the 20s. Remember this Russian physiologist placed glass tubes into a dog's salivary glands and measured the salivation in response to stimulus from food, for example. Hold up some meat, and the dog starts salivating, and he can measure how much. And then he came to, each time he did this, he'd put the food, and he'd accompany that food with the ringing of a bell. And so the two would come together. And eventually all he had to do was ring a bell, and the dog would salivate. So this is what you call the conditioned response. The dog was reconditioned to respond to a stimulus that ordinarily wouldn't produce salivation. He also discovered one other thing, that he could speed up this response by making the dog anxious. Making him nervous, upset, angry, any kind of emotional response tended to facilitate the conditioning process. And this became the basis for what happened in Russia, you know, where the communist government in Russia, back in those early days, were very much involved in trying to maneuver, manipulate people's attitudes toward the state so as to make them conform to the authoritarian structure. Stalin, for example, was very much involved in things like this. And they discovered that if you could take a person and put him in a situation of anxiety, that you might very well be able to facilitate that mind control. And they used this with great effectiveness. The Chinese then investigated in relationship to what they did after the revolution in China. Robert J. Lifton wrote a book on this once, in which he talked about such things as the confusion in the mind of the person who was being subjugated to the brainwashing, confusion about his identity. Including such things as telling him that his former friends had turned him in and so on and had turned against him and putting him in isolation, deprived him of sleep, and all sort of softening up procedures, and then would start putting on the pressure. It sometimes took as much as 2.5 years. But you get an individual who would start out rejecting the demand that he confess his crimes against the government. You know, they'd sit down across the table, and the interrogator would put a sheet of paper over for the prisoner to write on. He said, "Now you confess your crimes that you've committed against the government." Mm-hmm. And the person who was a missionary or somebody who was being interrogated would shove the sheet back at him. And so he'd go back to his cell for a little more softening up, lack of sleep and noise and whatever, and bring him back again. And finally, after the brainwashing had gone on for a period of time, the prisoner would catch the idea that what is wanted from him is making some kind of confession, that if maybe he made a confession, that they take the pressure off. And so he said, "If they want a confession, I'll give them a whopper." So he just filled in all kinds of details on his confession, saying, "Look, I spied against the people's government, and I tried to assassinate Mao Zedong," and all kinds of, you know, really very wild kind of admissions of guilt, only to have it shoved back at him. So it is insufficient. They didn't want the confession, they wanted the confessing. Mm-hmm. Because in the process of retaining no sense of private ownership, you symbolize and actually make the transformation of an individual accepting his subjugation to a dominant force, which is the state. He becomes a property of the state. Now, that kind of confession urge, mm-hmm. you see, helped to create the loss of a sense of self-worth. Mm-hmm. It tended to impress the sense of guilt. And this is exactly what the interrogators were trying to do.
But you know, that's incredibly like the Book of Job in the Old Testament.
Exactly. That's the reason I say this is...
It's that old.
This is kind of a fearsome notion.
Demonic, then.
In fact, there was a Roman Catholic bishop, yeah. a man by the name of Butler, who resisted the interrogation beautifully. They couldn't touch him. And somebody asked him in the interviews later how he was able to do this. He says, "I knew exactly what they were doing." He says, "The church had been doing this for centuries, except we're brainwashing people to God, and they're brainwashing people to the state." Well, you see, unknowingly, it is the case. Mm-hmm. The religious people have done things mm-hmm. which, in the light of the definition that I've given about the self, mm-hmm. may actually have to do with diminution of the self. Mm-hmm. Another psychiatrist, a man by the name of William Sargent, wrote a book, The Battle for the Mind, which mm-hmm. he talked about certain types of rhythmic music, particularly rock beat. The psychiatrist saying that, in fact, you can produce a dissociative state, hypersuggestibility, with such things that soften up a person mm-hmm. for manipulation. And William Sargent made a study of a snake-handling charismatic group back in North Carolina while he was here in the States mm-hmm. on a visit. Mm-hmm. And he said he visited their churches to see what happened. Mm-hmm. And he discovered an interesting phenomenon. He said there was a young man attending who was not religious. He came there to watch what was going on. And the local people had come to call this young man the devil, because what he was doing, he had discovered that these girls who had gone through this kind of ecstatic religious experience were more seducible afterwards. Mm-hmm. See, in other words, the rhythm, the music, the dissociative state, which is a kind of a hypnotic state that's produced, and the charismatic experience mm-hmm. had actually made these people vulnerable to manipulation. And by our definition then, you see, lessen their capacity for self-determination.
Are you implying that gospel rock might even
what
be
I'm, What indicted? I'm saying is that one had better look very carefully mm-hmm. at the manipulative effects mm-hmm. of this kind of experience. And since a great many people are involved in the charismatic movement, one would think that that's something that one ought to be thinking about ethically, mm-hmm. whether or not it is ethical to manipulate people with music or even with preaching. I've come to the conclusion that an ethical minister manipulating an audience, if he has sufficient sensitivity, will avoid pushing too far, mm-hmm. lest in fact he become more than just merely legitimately suggestible and not become manipulative. And I think I've seen a few examples of frank manipulation that reflected a lack of sensitivity on the part of clergymen. Mm. Decision-making, that's one of the capacities of a self, mm. to be able to make decisions, and we've suggested that in these manipulative types of techniques, one may have that capacity diminished. Decision-making is very much a part of the contemporary bioethical scene as well. One of the great questions that frequently comes up in a medical center where these issues are being faced is who shall decide? Time was when the physician simply made all the decisions. Hippocrates even said in his instruction to his disciples that physicians should never tell their patients what they have. You keep the patient in the dark, then you have control, and he will do what you say because he doesn't know any better. But this has been radically changed now, and the last ethics code book of the American College of Physicians has it frankly stated that the physician is the one of last resort. He's the one who should make the decisions.
Is that a long evolution to arrive at this point?
Oh, it's a long ways. It came over a long period of time, but in the last 25 years.
25?
It's very recent. You've shifted over now fully to where the patient is the one of last resort. Well, now in today's Los Angeles Times, there was an interesting account that you may have read about a family. They had one daughter, who was now a teenage daughter, but who had leukemia and temporarily in remission. They were trying to find some way to get a bone marrow transplant for her to see if they couldn't cure the disease. Because with a transplant thing, what they do is simply destroy all the bone marrow with radiation and then re-implant bone marrow from somebody who is not infected, and then this will grow and take the place of what had been killed by the radiation.
It was the lead story on the main channels today.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. And as you know, some of the ethicists became very unhappy about this, because what the parents decided to do was to have this woman get pregnant. They had to reconnect the vasectomy on the man, but get the woman pregnant, and then see if maybe having this live related donor, the baby could be used as a source of transplant for the bone marrow. The question was, is it right to bring a baby into the world for that purpose, to use the baby for somebody else's use? We had a case similar to that in which a woman's husband was on dialysis and became weary of it and wanted to quit and thus commit suicide. He stopped the machine, he was finished. And she hatched up a notion that if she could get pregnant by him, she could provide a live-related donor. They were having a hard time matching his tissue type for kidney transplant. And he was a rare type, and moreover, he had been an orphan, so he didn't have any living-related relatives that he knew. So this was the only way she'd get a live-related donor, was to get pregnant by him and then use that baby's kidneys, transplant those kidneys into him. And using both of them, it probably would work. But the physician wouldn't do it because they said, you don't have the right to make the use of a baby. Even
and the baby dies.
Of course, the baby would die.
Is this true in the leukemia case?
She took both kidneys. In this case, no. See, so it's not nearly as impressive a notion because you don't damage this baby irreparably by taking some of its bone marrow. But some of the ethicists are worried about the use of a baby for somebody else's purposes. Well, the parents are the ones who are making the decision for infants. Take our baby Faye case that we had some years ago. The question of who should decide whether or not baby Faye should have a baboon transplant was a very real question. Should Leonard Bailey make the decision? Or should it be made by the parents? The baby, according to our newer ways of dealing with decision-making, was the one who finally is the last resort, but the baby can't make decisions because it's too young, immature, incompetent. Well, it means that it is normally the case in practice now that when a person cannot decide, those who are deemed most likely to decide correctly, that is because of the interest in the patient for whom the decision is to be made, the ones most likely to be protective and have his best interest at heart are the ones who make the decision. And so we've tended to decide that parents should make the decision for their children, but they have to make a decision as the child would make it if the child were able to make the decision. And so baby-faced parents were supposed to go in there to this crib and say, now, baby Faye, what do you want us to do? See, because the baby can't answer. And then they have to kind of guess what she would want them to do. And they could probably guess with some reason that she'd want to be better. And so if the surgery would make her better off, they say, well, now that's what, if we were baby Faye, that's what we'd want it done, and so we'll assume that she wants that done. So she makes the decision by proxy. They become the surrogate deciders for her. And in the absence of this, then we go to hospital ethics committees, and then we go to the courts if we have nobody else to appeal to.
And if the parents disagree?
Or a family disagrees. More often a family gets in trouble. Yeah. Surviving children and others. Well, in this case, you're having parents making a decision for a baby, and probably because of the limited dangerous effect to the baby, this is probably worth doing. Ordinarily, one wouldn't, for example, take both the kidneys or take all that bone marrow from the tiny baby to give it to the sister in order for the baby to survive. But I would say that it'd be permissible for parents to make this kind of decision. But decision-making is a very real problem. And as a rule, we still want to say, because of the self has a right to make decisions that even though physicians may give you guidance so that it's an informed decision, at the same time it's your decision, and he must put that in your hands. And most physicians nowadays who are ethically trained and sensitive will say things like, well, these are the options, Mm-hmm. And this is what will happen if you do this, and this is what will happen if you do this. Now what do you want us to do? Mm-hmm. And sometimes patients will say back, Doc, what do you think I ought to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so you help. But at the same time, you recognize that this is no longer a paternalistic kind of relationship that physicians once used to have. And now patients participate in the decision-making. Well, that's probably enough on decision-making.
Mm-hmm. It's all highly subjective.
Oh, well,
it assumes integrity on the part of the people involved.
It surely does.
But what else can you do?
We have a certain number of checks and balances. We decide, mm-hmm. for example, whether parents are child abusers. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't ask a child abusing parent whether or not this baby ought to have certain kinds of major surgical procedures. Mm-hmm. So you have to be sure they're not conflicts of interest, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, discontinuing life support when there's an inheritance involved, mm-hmm. that gets very, very sticky. Down in Australia, there's an interesting case where using one of the modern techniques for reproduction, embryos were developed and frozen. Mm-hmm. The eggs were taken, they were fertilized outside of the uterus, and of the six that they selected, three of them were implanted in the mother's uterus. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work. And they saved the other three in case it didn't work, they could have some backup. And so they froze these other three. But unfortunately, before they could implant these other three in a second attempt, the woman in whom they were to be implanted and her husband were both killed in an airplane accident. And here are three surviving frozen embryos. And the thing that complicated the matter was that they left a sizable inheritance. They were wealthy people. The man left his wealth to a son by previous marriage, and the woman left her wealth to her mother, who was a survivor. Well now, do you ask that son by previous marriage whether or not these embryos should be implanted in somebody's uterus and thus share in the inheritance? See, his conflict of interest would make him not a person to ask. And there were something like 20 or 30 women who agreed publicly to become their surrogate parents for those frozen embryos. Well, but you go and ask, in his case, they did ask him, what do you want to do with these embryos? Mm-hmm. He said, I don't care what you do with them. He said, they were conceived by artificial insemination, so therefore they really have no inheritance in my father's will in any case.
Mm-hmm.
And since artificial insemination had not worked itself out into a kind of a legal formula in Australia, this was kind of perplexing. But the woman, had a genetic kind of tie to these embryos. Mm-hmm. But would you ask her, do you want these embryos to be implanted and become children so they can share in your inheritance? Well, they wouldn't, because this would be a conflict of interest, and so the choosing the chooser becomes an ethical kind of concern. So what courts finally did was to announce that they were going to allow the embryos to thaw out and disintegrate, but they'd leave enough time for the populace to respond negatively or positively and guide them in it, and there wasn't enough response against it, so the embryos disappeared.
That was a moot question.
It was a moot question. You see, the decision making gets kind of complicated.
Yeah. That hit the news too, as I recall.
Oh, yes, it did.
Yeah.
It was
the public is being confronted with these things.
Very much. But there's another aspect of the ethical enterprise that follows our concern for protecting the self. The self is our highest concern. What God is doing in the world to keep human life human is what God is doing in the world with the rules and guidance he gives us to help us to manifest those qualities that have to do with selfhood. He created selves, and he wants those selves to survive and do what selves were intended to do, including to determine their behavior and to choose and so on. But if you're going to protect the self, you've got to also protect, as a second line of defense, the willingness to protect the self. That is, the sensitivities of individuals involved. This becomes an obvious kind of issue at the point where people make decisions regarding whether or not to discontinue life support. Suppose you decide, maybe they decide in the case of Nancy Beth Cruzan, that they're going to discontinue the life support system, including a gastric tube. If they decided to do this and they know she's going to die, then why not kill her at once instead of letting her die over a period of time?
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to consult on a baby in the hospital some years ago who was suffering from a terrible disease, a disease that is not that uncommon in premature babies, in which their gut tract is not sufficiently mature to be able to deal with the ingested bacteria that go with the normal feeding process. And so she developed what was known as acute necrotizing enterocolitis. Mm-hmm. Terribly big word for a little small baby to have to deal with. It means a part of the bowel died. Well, there's only one treatment of it, and that is to go in and take the piece of bowel out. And so they did. And the baby did very well for a little while. And then another portion of the bowel developed the same problem. And so they had to go in again and take out another portion of the bowel. And then a third time it happened. And by the time they had finished those three surgeries, the baby had about that much bowel left to which to attach the stomach. No intestine. Now, it may be a pain in the neck sometimes, but it just happens that the intestine is a vital organ. If you don't have an intestine, you're in for trouble. And so they were left with a serious question. There's only one way this baby could survive now, and that is with a newer technique that's been developed in the last couple of decades, in which you can, by intravenous feeding alone, produce an indeterminate period of time of survival. And this intravenous kind of feeding is a complicated kind of notion, involves a great deal of expense, but it can be done. And so we're faced with the situation, this tiny baby, barely surviving three major surgeries, that who can only survive now if we decide to put that baby on intravenous feedings for the rest of its life. And we don't know how long we can keep a person alive that way, but suppose you know, we keep a baby alive for 65 years with nothing but intravenous feedings. Do you want to do that to a newborn baby? That was the question. The parents finally decided no, with great anguish, because they loved this baby. It was a beautiful child. In every respect, except that it was premature and a little bit skinny because of its prematurity, but except for this illness, it was a lovely child. But they thought about this, and they thought about what would happen when the child gets a little older. She's on intravenous feedings, total parenteral nutrition, they call it, TPN. And she's on this total parenteral nutrition, and she has a birthday party. How do you have a birthday party when you have total parenteral nutrition? So all the children next door come over and play, you know, and then they have ice cream and cake, and she goes in the back room and gets her IV. She becomes an adolescent and has to constantly be aware of the need that she has for recourse to her parenteral feeding. And the parents thought of all this and came back and made the decision, we will not do that to our baby.
Did you talk to the parents?
I didn't talk to the parents. I talked to the people who did.
Okay.
But they said, we will not do that to our baby. So they said, do not institute total parenteral nutrition. Well, if you've decided that, then why not simply kill the baby right there instead of letting it starve to death over a couple of weeks? It does seem more humane to simply strangle the baby or hit it in the head or something with a hammer or whatever.
Some kind way.
But why not? See, and now you move from passive euthanasia to active euthanasia, which is one of our very real problems. And there are reasons why some of us would say no, you must let nature do it rather than we do it. You see, the right to die does not include the right to be killed. And this is kind of the way the formula goes, is the difference between active and passive euthanasia. Passive euthanasia means you step back and let nature take its course.
An act of God?
And unfortunately, that kind of bad theology can sometimes get involved in it. But an active euthanasia, in the usual sense of the word, means I do something to give it a shove. See, I've decided this baby's going to die in 2 weeks, and I just can't stand to see it suffer, so therefore I mercifully take its life. Well, now the same thing could happen to Nancy Cruzan. See, we could decide, since we're going to take the tube out and she's going to starve to death, let's also give her an overdose of morphine or something, so she can peacefully go to sleep now. Well, the reason you can't do this is because active euthanasia involves a very interesting introduction into the process, a responsible behavior on the part of the physician who's practicing it. He becomes somewhat responsible for an act. He's done something, he causes something that becomes he's attached to. And the point that I'm trying to make will be illustrated, I think, by something else that happened in this hospital. Some years ago, I was investigating the guidelines that are on the books about how to discontinue life support. And there's a very interesting paragraph contained in those guidelines that said if you discontinue the life support and the patient dies immediately thereafter, that is, if the life support you're giving makes it so that if you discontinue it, the patient will immediately die, then you can't discontinue it. You cannot associate that sudden death with the action. And I asked to find out why this was included in the guidelines, and they told me an interesting tale. there was a young woman who'd been up on the oncology floor, and it was just shortly before death. She was terminal, practically, and she wanted to go home to die. So they released her to go home and die with her family at home. But the family became panicky as she got into trouble after a few days, and they came rushing back to the emergency room. They brought her into the emergency room, and while she was in the emergency room, she went into cardiac arrest and simply quit breathing and died by the old definitions of death. Mm-hmm. And of course, the crew is well trained for this sort of an event, and they quickly resuscitated her. Mm-hmm. And she's back now talking to them again. And by this time now, they were able to get a hold of her chart. They hadn't had a chart before. It took a little while to get that down, and this was an emergency situation, see? And finally the chart gets down, and they discover the history, that she'd been released to go home and die. Mm. And now she's going to have to die all over again.
They reversed it.
So they called up the chief and said, what do you want us to do with your patient? They gave the story. Mm-hmm. He said, what on earth are you people doing? He said, she went home to die, mm-hmm. and now she has to do it all over again. Discontinue that ventilator, the head on a ventilator. Discontinue it. And they said, oh no, if anybody's going to discontinue that ventilator, you're going to have to come and do it, because we're not going to do it. Yeah. Well, he said, ask her what she wants. Well, now, I don't know whether you're in position to make a decision when you've just come out of a coma, and whether you understand the implications of this, but they asked her. And she said, yes. She didn't want them to do it. Mm-hmm. She wanted them to quit. So they discontinued it. And she died. But an enormous stress to the people who pulled the plug. Mm-hmm. See? In other words, in their minds, the closeness of the cause to the event associated them together so that the one becomes the cause for the other.
They're complying with the wishes of the patient,
even
doing the patient a favor.
Even doing that,
hurt them.
They felt the guilt mm-hmm. of having killed her. Mm-hmm. See, and this was traumatic. So discontinuance of life support, you have to really let nature do it. And not give the appearance that you're giving nature a push in order to avoid the kinds of meanings. In other words, what we're suggesting is that our sensitivities about our acts are also a part of a protective mechanism for preserving the significance of our acts. And if I care about saving persons, looking after persons, I must also care about caring about patients mm-hmm. who are to be protected or to be treated. I diagram this sometimes as the following way, a center circle that represents the self. Yeah. And we must protect that self from the direct onslaughts, chemicals, even ill health. There's a morality and health involved in here, because it is the case that illness can diminish one's capacity for self-determination, for responsibility. And if it's self-induced illness, there is a sense in which you owe a moral responsibility for having lessened your capacity to be a person, mm-hmm. to be a self. Mm-hmm. It isn't a sin to be sick, but it may be a sin to be sicker than you need to be. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you become responsible for your ill health, there is kind of a moral implication to that, it seems to me, and deriving from this kind of ethic that protects the self. Are the self in the center, and then surrounding that, mm-hmm. a bulwark of activities that help us to protect our sensitivities. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you another story. This was an elderly...
Could I ask you around on this other one?
Oh, yes.
It's so gripping. Would it be possible for a physician of sufficient maturity and sensitivity, a really caring physician, to have terminated the treatment, taken her off the respirator, whatever it was, and watch her die and not be hurt by it? But people looking on might be hurt. He might not.
Well, I'd be a little afraid that his ability to do it means that he's been hurt already. See?
Think he's callous to be able to do that?
One can blunt one's sensitivities so that, in mm-hmm. fact, one could do a thing like this. You know, any sin can eventually become something that doesn't bother you very much if you keep doing it often enough.
He couldn't be deeply sensitive as he does it. Like the husband recently, remember the case?
Who shot his wife?
Yes. Yeah. Was he calloused? Was he hardened?
But he was pained by having done it.
Yes.
So this was not a casual thing that happened in his life.
And yet he was willing to endure the pain.
He was willing to do it because of his compassion for her. And I think the motivation, there's reasons for doing it, conditioned mightily its ethics.
Compassion and sensitivity here, wrestling with each other?
Well, it seems to me that being compassionate expresses a certain kind of a sensitivity, so they're not really opposing notions.
No.
They kind of fit together.
You can imagine his agony then in the whole experience.
Oh, sure. But the point is that the society itself can become blunted, and our compassion can be lost by overexposure to, or exposure to a very sensitivity shattering experiences. And I think this is one of the reasons we have to be somewhat worried about the kind of things that our children watch or we watch on television. There are even some true things that one ought not to be exposed to.
Because you're often reminding us there aren't just one or two people involved, there are many others involved.
We're talking about a social kind of ethic in which we're not just dealing with one person, one-to-one relationship to a moral act. Mm-hmm. We're talking about preserving the values of a society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did they get down that road to Auschwitz and Dachau? Mm-hmm. See, they went down there step by step.
Mm-hmm.
And people became physicians who would do things to patients in those German hospitals that were extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
We're even asking now about whether or not it is ethical to take the findings that they developed in those studies.
Yeah.
Whether it wasn't so horrendous that we ought to just throw the whole thing out and never even touch it.
Mm-hmm.
But how did they get there? You don't get there by a single bound.
Mm-hmm.
You descend that ladder step by step.
So you're extremely cautious about taking the first step direction.
Surely, you see. And the good reasons for setting up safeguards so that society can maintain its sensitivities.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good thing to have people care in ways that keep them from stepping down that's what is sometimes called a slippery slope too far.
And if you were to lean one way or the other, would you lean toward being extra caring, extra sensitive?
I should think. Since that's what's vulnerable is our sensitivity. To protect it means you lean over backward and to look after. So there are certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of rules that have to do with protecting their sensitivity. A society that wants to maintain the capacity for caring had better use whatever techniques are possible to enable one to do this. And I say this is one of the reasons why it is ethically legitimate to start questioning the enormity of the violence to which our children are being exposed on television and elsewhere. It's, you know, it's an incredible picture. A child, by the time she's early teenage, will have seen thousands of murders, but as entertainment. Now, she knows these are entertainment because nobody could watch that in reality without being really very much moved by it. So they become accustomed to thinking, he's just playing games, cops and robbers, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that subtly, the enormity of it is bound to make the meaning of the action different. And as a consequence, it is my conviction that, that the society itself, a social ethical issue is at stake in whether or not we are allowing our children to be exposed to the enormity of violence that they are. And the violence we're seeing on our city streets is one of the prices we're paying for this. One of the most violent countries in the world is the United States.
Now, when you speak of allowing, you talk about people making decisions. I mean, can we resort to law to control this kind of thing?
Well, I think that there are cases in which there's nothing short of this, but law is only effective. Social legislation is only effective when there's a consensus that supports it.
Yeah.
And so it's whether or not law can do it. If you have an action or a kind of behavior that is socially acceptable, even if it's wrong, you can't make laws prohibiting it, because you're going to have bad law and people disrespecting law in the process. And then again, I think there's a certain hazard involved in law stepping in too soon, particularly in private morality. Private morality is terribly important, but private morality is usually the subject for preaching and for teaching and for exhortation and not for legislation. Simply because it is a question of intrusion into the sphere of private inner life by forces that ought not to be intruding. Well, then I'm saying that the setting up patterns of behavior, even if you can't make a law out of it, certainly by education, you ought to say, this is wrong because if we do this, we're going to lose a part of our ability to look after that central self quality, which is so important. But that concern for the self is not only a question of sensitivity at that level. There are certain kinds of social structures that protect that concern for the self. For example, the family is a social structure. And it is the case that in a family, it is a normal kind of family, the kind of family God intended it to be, is a setting in which selfhood is maximized. And that's part of the function of a family, a social institution that has to do with maximizing selfhood. So that the ethic that places great priority on the self as the ethical concern norm that also looks after the sensitivities that protect that, but also protects the social institutions that tend to protect that. But one more word about the sensitivity one. Let me tell you a story that comes out of my own medical practice. For a few years ago, I had a patient. It was an elderly woman who had a series of small strokes and was sort of incontinent. She had to wear a diaper all the time. And she stayed at home. The daughter loved her and kept her at home and looked after her. And she couldn't talk very well. But she was still, you know, still with it enough so that you say she was a self, even if a diminished self. And then one night the daughter called me. She said, "Doctor, come quick. Something's happened to Mother." So I came, and here was this lady lying in bed, deeply comatose, not a sign of any recognition of anything. Her breathing was erratic, and her pulse was irregular. And we sent her off to the hospital. I checked her over some more and realized that the lady had a serious stroke, and that she probably wasn't going to survive it. She was that near death already. So I went to the daughter, and I said to her, "Now, your mother has had a serious stroke, and she may live for 2 or 3 days, or maybe even a few hours. But you better prepare yourself for it. This is your mother's last illness." She was quiet for a long time. Then she said to me, "Doctor," she said, "I don't want you to do anything for Mother. Don't do anything." Well, now, if I had taken her quite literally, I could have said, "All right, we'll put her on a gurney, we'll move her down to the morgue and let her cool off down in the morgue. It's cheaper there than in a hospital bed," see. But that wasn't what she meant. She meant, don't come running with a crash cart and put her on a ventilator and keep her going with all those fancy gadgets.
That'd be very nice to her. She's my mother.
So I said to her, in terms of what I've been describing to you as an ethical sensitivity, I said to her, "There isn't very much we can do for your mother, but we'll do everything we can to keep her comfortable."
Yeah.
And clinically, I was right. I mean, I couldn't bring back her brain, which was irreparably damaged by the stroke. But we'll do everything we can to keep her comfortable. Well, now it happens the lady's in a deep coma. And by definition, that's as comfortable as you can get already. She wouldn't know if I'd put her on a gurney and pick her down to the morgue to die. Only the daughter would know. She wouldn't know. She's comfortable already. So who was I treating? Obviously, I'm treating the daughter. I would want her to have a feelings of guilt, because she now let her mother down at the last minute when she needed her so much. I wanted to know there wasn't anything could be done, and that she'd done everything she could, and she was being a good daughter, and so on. But I was treating somebody else. I was treating me. I was treating the nurses that had to do with her care. Even if this old lady was no longer a self, there is a sense in which she still had human meaning to us. She stood for human. She was somebody's mother. See, not dead in the terms of symbolic meanings of that word, so she could be diagnosed as a corpse, so we could send for the undertaker. She still meant somebody's mother, a human being. And so we did what was appropriate for our sakes. It didn't make any difference to her. The nurses came in, kept her clean, fluffed her hair, fluffed her pillows, and looked after her. I stopped by every day, and I took her blood pressure and did little routine things for my sake, for our sakes. Because I want to be a compassionate, caring physician. And because of the very nature of our human dependence upon symbols, how you look after that which has symbolic human meaning conditions our ability to look after that which is, in fact, genuinely, actively human. If you don't protect your sensitivities, then we pay the price.
You've been committed to this all through your practice of medicine.
Yes. And I've tried to instill that in my students.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what the healing profession is about. And of course that makes nonsense to a person who's commercialized his medical practice, because it's more expensive to let this patient die over a period of time than it is to inject a massive dose of morphine. So that there's a sense in which commercialization can modify one's ability to be ethical. But in a Christian sense, Judeo-Christian sense, where compassion, care, and concern, and the desire to protect sensitivity will protect not only the self we're looking after, but protect the sensitivities of those we look after. I care about being compassionate, so therefore, I refuse to do those things which will lessen my ability to be caring.
So you're not just treating the patient.
No.
You're treating yourself and the family.
We're treating the whole of us.
And the nurses and everybody else.
All the people who are involved. I'll tell you about another case.
Okay. The case is really effective, aren't it?
This one was a really toughie. Patient came in a busy afternoon, and since I was teaching and only seeing patients part-time, I had to organize my schedule so that I could see as many patients as I could in a minimal amount of time. And so they came in by appointment. And in the middle of a very busy afternoon, a gentleman, middle-aged, slightly obese, who I've been looking after for a slight amount of high blood pressure, came in to the girl at the window and said, "Look, I've got to see Doc." She said, "He's busy. What do you want to see him about?" He said, "I've got a headache." Well, she said, "You take 2 aspirins and go home, and then call him tomorrow and make an appointment. He'll see you if you don't feel better." But I got a headache, and I don't think aspirin is going to help his headache. So she came to see me between patients and said, look, Victor's out here, and he's got a serious headache, he says, and would you like to see him? I said, he's got a headache. I said, I've got a headache. Half my patients have headaches. But then I remembered he's pretty stoic about his pain, so I said, better slip him in a room, I'll look at him. So I went into the room and I did a quick neurological check and looked for pressure in the eye grounds and for reflex changes. No reason that I could find for a headache. Blood pressure was up a little bit, but not very much, not enough for a headache. So I said to him, take 2 aspirin, go home, but you call me in an hour if your headache hasn't disappeared. Mm. See, this was kind of...
Not tomorrow morning.
No, this was a test of therapy, because any serious thing that's causing a headache isn't going to respond to a couple of aspirin. See, in an hour's time, he's still going to be in trouble. Well, he was home a half an hour, and I got a call on the telephone saying, come quick, Daddy's on the floor in the bathroom. Mm. So I rushed to this house, and here he is lying on the floor. He's semi-comatose, kind of blabbering and talking and wiggling around and so on. We quickly got him in an ambulance to send him to the hospital. Mm. By the time I got there, the emergency room doctor already had him hooked up to life support. And within the first 10 minutes of my arrival, I watched his pupils dilate and become fixed, and the reflexes all disappeared. He's on a ventilator. His heart is still beating on a monitor because he's hooked up these machines, but he's dead. Mm. By brain death definition. I even did an electroencephalogram. The brain tracing was perfectly flat. Well, I said to the family, I said, I'm sorry, but this is what has happened. He's had a major stroke, and in retrospect, probably what happened, it started to leak a little bit and mm-hmm. gave him a headache, but it hadn't leaked enough yet to give him any neurological signs I could pick up. But when he got home, the thing got blue and he had mm-hmm. a serious accident. Well, I told him what had happened. He said, oh, no, but you look at that monitor. You know, in the intensive care room, they're hooked up to a constant reading mm-hmm. of the heart pattern. And they said, look at that, his heart's beating. He can't be dead. So I said, well, that's, if we take off these machines, that won't happen. They said, don't you shut off the machines. Now, here's a poor family, not poor enough to be on Medicaid, mm-hmm. but too poor to pay for this. And this is intensive care. I don't know what intensive care costs these days, but I suspect it's about a fortune every day.
Yes.
And they didn't have insurance.
I had a daughter on that for about 2 months.
They didn't have any insurance. You know what it cost them. They didn't have any insurance. And here he is, by my definition, dead. Mm-hmm. By their definition, still alive. And they refused to let me shut off the ventilator. Now the question is, what shall I do? Mm. See? The family was adamant. Don't shut off that ventilator. We let this go for several days. Took some more electroencephalographs and even got a report back from the neurologist saying patient has suffered cerebral death. See? But they wouldn't let me shut it off. What do I do? I called an internist who was walking by. I said, come in here and give a consult. Mm-hmm. He took one look and he said, well, I'm glad you're running the case. He said, this is an ethical problem. You take care of it.
He had another patient quickly.
And so finally, what I had to do, and I think I was legitimate doing it, was to serve them in compassion. Mm-hmm. I didn't kill him. But I said, leave the vasopressor substance out of the IV. That was keeping his blood pressure up, see, artificially with his medication. Leave that out of the IV and let nature take over. Mm-hmm. So they could see nature's process at work. So I didn't actively kill him. Yeah. If I got over and pulled the plug, mm-hmm. he died instantly. Mm-hmm. Then you see, in the eyes of the family, as well as in my own eyes, I'd be causally related in some way to the outcome. Mm-hmm. But by letting nature take over, it took about 11 hours for it to happen. Mm-hmm. And then gradually his blood pressure began to fall, his pulse rate became erratic and irregular, and finally flattened out.
And they were watching this?
And they could watch that.
And they accepted that?
They accepted it. See? But see, the difference between active and passive euthanasia. One, in a way that I did not prefer, because I would wish that they could have accepted this kind of picture along with me. But since they couldn't, my concern for them meant that I had to do what was right, but to do it in such a way as to preserve his dignity, mm-hmm. to preserve our care and our human compassion.
And again, you weren't treating the patient.
Yeah.
You were treating the family.
Treating the family. The patient was already dead. The question was now, how do you announce that so that they'll accept it? And they finally came to accept it. But that gives you an illustration mm-hmm. of the difference between the two kinds of notions. It also tells you about the definition of self. In my mind, mm-hmm. this man was self-dead because all of the material, all of the objective signs of brain death were present. You don't have a self if a brain is gone. Mm-hmm. So he's dead. Now how do you treat a corpse and maintain our humaneness while you do it? Mm-hmm. Look after the dignity of the patient and our own sensitivities, and thus be sure that the right thing has been done.
What are you going to turn to next time?
We can go several directions that I think about.
Yes. Oh, thanks, Matt.
But law should move in to protect
my rights against the intrusion of yours. So therefore, the law ought to say you don't smoke in this place because you're contaminating other people's air on airplanes. And alcohol. We had prohibition once, trying to prohibit the use of alcohol. And all we did was to create enormous problems from this because a very significant segment of society had not yet gained consensus on that notion. So they were violating the law. And moreover, if the law had been properly set up, it would be a law against driving on my highway when you're drunk, or even endangering your children. A person who deprives his family because of his addiction to alcohol. There could perhaps be some regulation for this. I think that we're going to do something about that.
Where did, you know, did you get some of the minds of some of the judiciary and leaders that think that we might as well decriminalize the use of this stuff? You can explore that area, and then also you think about some of these crimes, and you've got all the evidence there. I think the society, we still need to go through the criminal procedure, the public trial, even though we need to have those systems and those procedures in place. And the same thing with the ethical decisions in determining as to when the person is really dead and so on and so forth.
You see, you're talking about a different function of law now, however. This is not punitive law, this is educative law. And sometimes law is the only way you can educate some people about morality. But education is part of the role of ethics. And we need to be sure that we get things in their proper order. That one does the educating before one starts putting the legal patterns in, so that you have a consensus developed through ethics. And that may include sometimes some court actions as part of the education. One way you can tell a child that one act is worse than another, or some acts are terribly bad, is to have a penalty that gives that information. You don't have the penalty, some people never learn. Some people, the only morality they have is the morality of law as they understand it. I heard a patient person once say, he said, I think I'm ready for the Lord to come. He said, I never broke any laws. As though breaking the laws of the country are synonymous with being ethical. And ethics are much more sensitive than law and can get in areas where law shouldn't go. But if you use law as an educative function, then you're still making law serve ethics.
Mm-hmm. What is society going to do with mothers who ingest drugs while they're pregnant?
I think that we're going to have some laws because we're going to have to protect the fetus. And in my picture, you have to make those laws in such a way as to make them be productive, not counterproductive.
Because where do you draw the line? Do you put them in jail?
I don't think we need to punish them with a jail experience, but we need to have some way of controlling their behavior. In other words, maybe a nice jail. One with curtains on the windows and things, so it's a pleasant place to be, so it isn't punitive, but at the same time, restrict their activities so that they don't have access to these fetus-destroying chemicals. And that's part of, I think, a recognition.
In your case, a heroin mother, 6 months pregnant, who wants to get off heroin, starts withdrawing, and the baby is in distress. Can you OB says, this mother must stay on heroin.
Ah.
Yes. That was the clinical
diagnosis. That's kind of incredible. No, but I think that she wants to be off drugs, and she ought to have available to her some place where she can go, where she can be supervised and prevented from having access to them for the sake of peace.
You see, the problem with that is that we now have medications that will control all those side effects. And if that woman was in a very controlled environment, she could progressively be taken off of heroin, onto other things, and then off of everything without disturbing either her or the baby significantly.
So So politically, is this starting? Are we starting to address this?
Yes, yes. There are a number of states that are working in that direction. Unfortunately, the easy route is to be punitive. We'll punish these people for doing this to their fetuses. Mm-hmm. And there are even some suits that have been raised, which mothers have been sued for having done this to their offspring.
They haven't been very successful.
No, it's a mixed bag at this moment. But I think that the notion of being punitive, of punishing the mother for doing this to her fetus, doesn't take into account the whole tragedy of addiction. But I think what they need is assistance and help. But the kind of supervision that protects the fetus. I think sooner or later we have to do that with an enormous number of offspring that are suffering fetal alcohol syndrome and so on. Yeah, it's terrible. Yes. Mm-hmm.
One question that's always been kind of in the back of my mind is about babies and abortion. It's the way I look at it is some of these babies, I know my mom works at the NICU. A lot of these babies, they've got all these disfiguring disorders and all these things. It's like, what kind of life is the baby going to have?
That's a good question for us to consider.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because you want to know what kind of disorder. I suppose you were born without that right arm. Would you rather have not been born?
No, but I'm thinking about things.
Yeah, sure.
Serious.
But now you're already doing the thing that I'm suggesting. Because there are certain types of disability which are incompatible with that baby ever being able to function as a human, or even surviving. An anencephalic was born. The first baby I delivered as a medical intern, and the first baby that I had.
Yes.
The one that I carried all the way through prenatal care and so on, and then I delivered her, didn't have any head. Its face, just on the face, on some top of its shoulders. It was an anencephalic.
That's like for a first case.
It didn't survive. It wiped me out of obstetrics, but it didn't survive. It was a terrible thing happened. See? But now, the body ordinarily gets rid of its own garbage. Most of the abortions are performed by the body itself spontaneously. And the body should ordinarily have discharged this very defective fetus very early in its experience. It may be early enough that the mother may not even know she's pregnant. It could have gotten rid of this by spontaneous abortion. See? But since the body didn't do it, part of my function as a physician is to make up where the body fails. We do this constantly in our treatment. The body's supposed to do things. God built a lot of wisdom into this body. The wisdom of the body is a very nice expression. But sometimes the body doesn't do what it's supposed to do. So then sometimes we have to move in and help the body do what it's supposed to do. And in the case of a grossly abnormal baby, that involved the self organ, the brain. See, the body was supposed to have discarded this. It didn't, so therefore I'll help it. That's a legitimate reason for abortion. Seriously deformed babies, particularly if they involve the central nervous system, the brain, with the alpha fetal proteins intestinal, we can sometimes predict that those kinds of defects very early.
Wasn't there an argument last year, the year before that, Rights lifers were, I think it was at
Loma Linda. Oh, yeah, the anencephalic.
The baby, they wanted, the baby had no brain, but the lifers were mad because they wanted to use some of its organs or something
sure.
for transplants.
Yeah.
But they said, no, it's a human being, it's living.
Yeah, but you see, and this is what we discussed the last time where I talked about what it is that really dies when you are dead. And we said it's the self that dies. You die as a self, not just as an organ. You die as a self. And an anencephalic baby, since it doesn't have any brain, it has maybe have a brain stem, so it'll live for a little while, but it doesn't have any brain that's going to do any thinking or any choosing or the things that we talk about as selfhood, it never will be a self. And under those circumstances, it can be treated as born self-dead, and it's available for organs, I think. Now, the laws don't yet permit this because we have a limited definition of death with brain death, but I think that the law should be changed to allow the definition of death to be permitted in a situation where there's still a brain stem, it may live for 2 or 3 weeks, but will never be a self because it doesn't have the organ for selfhood. So I think the body itself gives us the guidance indicates that abortion may be appropriate under certain circumstances because it does it itself. Most of the time, I listened to somebody once, and my percentages aren't correct, but they're within the ballpark. Take 100 pregnancies, that is 100 times when the eggs come in contact with the sperm, that about 20% of those will simply be lost because they never implant. The mother will never know that that the egg was fertilized. Another 20% may be implanted, but will be lost early, will come disconnected, and will abort early. Again, perhaps too early for the mother to even know she was pregnant. And then another 20% or so will be lost along the way, have a higher level of maturation through a miscarriage or whatever. So when you get through, he says something like this, that out of every 100 times that an egg encounters a sperm, only about 5 of those ever get to be babies. And a significant number of those embryos are simply lost by the body's own spontaneous destruction. And most of those that are spontaneously aborted, or at least a great many of them, are abnormal embryos and might be anencephalics or other serious things. So the body does it itself, and I say a physician may have a right and a duty to help the body do what the body was supposed to do and it didn't do.
Mm-hmm. You have
the
head and trunk and no
brain. Well, that's fecal myelia is a condition. Remember we had this tranquilizer, what was the name of it?
Thalidomide.
Yeah, thalidomide, who produced this very frequently.
She was a farmer, and she was sprayed in
chemicals. That's fecal myelia, and I saw a person interviewed who was like that on TV a while back. No legs and no arms. Little kind of little flippers up here that he uses.
Mm-hmm.
But they're virtually without extremities. And they asked this person, would he rather have been aborted than to have been born? And his answer was unequivocal. He'd a whole lot rather have been born than not have been born at all. And he'd learned how to adapt this. He'd never known anything else. If he'd never had any arms, I mean, birds don't have any arms, and they don't seem to miss them. They have wings and no arms. But if you'd never had any arms or any legs, and had learned how to manage, and people were helping you, what goes on up here is where self is involved. See, if you have a.
We were out to dinner at a Chinese restaurant. We had a large aquarium,
uh-huh.
And he was totally fascinated. He was spellbound.
Oh, sure. See? Now that's a limited life as far as I'm concerned. And for me to lose my arms and legs now, that's a different matter. But if I were born with no arms and no legs, I have to make the adjustment to that. And it's a normal adjustment to me because I don't know anything else. But this person that was interviewed that I saw was really quite happy with the life that he lived. So that I'm saying that the kind of defects that you'd really want to give you guidance for this would be the kind of defects that would affect the brain to the place where a self could never develop.
The ability to think and to do.
That's right.
Do you think that any of these ethical issues in terms of drugs would be solved someday, or could be solved someday better by legalizing drugs?
Boy, I don't know. It's a tough question. Because,
I've had a big discussion about it over at UCR recently, a panel debate, and some of the people came to me and said, tell me what we should say on this panel.
That's a tough one. There are arguments on both sides of it, and I suspect that there's not a single answer. It would depend a bit upon the other things that one's doing in the community. If you have, for example, a very strong, educated thing, and you have in the schools a lot of kids who are on the side of no drugs, and the whole current is going that direction, then to solve the violent aspect of it, it might be that one could say, this is wrong.
Lesser of evils.
This is wrong to use drugs, but it's a lesser of evils that we don't socially move in and prohibit its use. Now, I think one could safely say, however, that even under those circumstances, the people who distribute, people who manufacture, could very well make this illegal. The only thing you might leave free would be the same thing we will allow with cigarettes. I don't think the time will ever come when we'll make it illegal to smoke. We're just going to make it illegal to smoke in certain places. We control advertising and so on.
Will we be able to make it illegal to make cigarettes?
They don't even make their own.
I think probably that, again, it comes to private morality.
See, the thing about cigarettes is, right now, we will see what happens, but right now I find it almost, you know, I moved with my patient load to tremendous range of society, almost universally, people, except for young teenage kids, and particularly girls, almost everybody else I talk to, no matter where they, whether they're smokers or non-smokers, think that everybody should be non-smokers. And that kind of societal move, shift in thinking, is going to make it, I at least has the potential for making it very unacceptable to be a smoker over time.
Well, sure, and I think eventually that if you get enough of a consensus against tobacco in a society where you can get away with it, that they'll pass laws.
Yeah.
Those laws including manufacture and distribution or whatever, maybe even laws against smoking. But until you have that kind of a consensus, then it'll be bad law. But it might still not be ethically correct to make rules. When you consider the permissiveness of God, who allowed us even to destroy ourselves, he does everything he can to keep us from doing it. He finally says, if that's what you want to do, you can do it. And so I think that prohibitions, that where law starts moving into areas that are properly the domain of morality and ethics, is bad law. We have lots of bad laws.
If we as Adventists, and myself as an Aurora Newlands too, if we address the issues as smoking, drinking, drugs, and meat eating, as health issues, should we also be addressing the use of the chemicals on our food supply, the pesticide issue?
Oh, sure.
Where I'm at, it's a very serious situation. Our water supplies being contaminated, soil, air.
Yeah, the fallout notions that I take to this notion of God as the creator and sustainer, it's God's sky, it's God's water, and there's a sense in which it is disrespectful to God. It's an affront to God to violate His creation.
These chemicals are known to cause human mutation, and that might be what we
could
be dealing with as
a society. So there's no question what environmental concern is. For a people who care about creation, which we always will if we keep the Sabbath becomes a symbolic reinforcer of a notion. We shall always be concerned about creation, and that includes our bodies as well, because the finest part of God's creation is our physical organism, and God does expect us to look after His creation.
How many vegetables and vegetarians we should be concerned about what's on those vegetables and biotechnology that we're putting out here?
See, they live up pretty close to the lettuce country and
right.
Everything. you see all that. Yes. Will you be devoting much of one session to abortion and so on? I assume that would be coming up.
Yeah, if you
which raises a lot of appropriate questions.
I'd like to see it, since we can't give a whole course in ethics in the time that I have available.
Yes.
And the energy that I have available over a weekend. We want to pick out areas that you're interested in exploring.
You could tell immediately tonight.
Yeah.
Because I want to ask you then, to what extent one's theological convictions enter into this?
There's a divided. They're about as divided as the courts are.
And,
I thought at USC there was quite prominent back in the baby faith.
Alexander Kaplan.
Yeah.
I think he'd be probably pro-life, pro-choice, I mean.
Was he?
Yeah, I think so. See, the American Bar Association has just gone pro-choice.
I noticed the vote.
Well, exactly, yeah. Don't you decide those cases? Can't they be decided case by case and not be mass?
Well, at least your principles should be decided in advance, but the application of those principles to specific cases will be highly individual. For example, when you talk about defects, you have to decide how much defect becomes now legitimation for doing the abortion. And those are decisions that have to be decided on the individual case, of course.
But if you've got a soul there, a spirit there, this is another issue. So can there ever be agreement on this?
Well, that's what I say. Part of the reason for the disagreement in this country is simply because we have theological disagreement. The definition of the human is what's at stake here.
Which is much of the subject of your first presentation.
So we have to solve that one first before we'll really be able to solve the...
We're getting into church-state issues then.
Mm.
I thought they were supposed to be kept separate. But they can't be, can they?
Not really, in the sense of morality, at least.
Well, this is like after Sabbath school. The best session comes afterwards. And Jack has two of these tomorrow morning.
Such as Roman Catholicism has sometimes traditionally been, is enhanced by the urge to the confessional.
Each time a person goes to the confessional, instead of confessing to God, he's confessing to the church and its representative.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which this then makes one a subject of this authoritarian force. And Bishop Butler was quite right.
Gradually diminishes their ability to make their own choice. Symbolically,
sort of surrendering themselves to the church every time they go to the confessional.
Boy, you're vulnerable from then on. There was a lovely cartoon that showed, right after the meeting of Gorbachev and Pope John Paul, it showed Gorbachev in the confessional on one side, Pope John Paul on the other. And here was Gorbachev with this long, long list that ran way out. And he says, I really don't know where to begin. And it listed all the crimes of the Soviet leadership through the years. But that's an old method if you find it in Job. We could go on all night, couldn't we? Wouldn't it be good?
No, we can't.